Good evening, and welcome to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio station. Tonight's episode of The Talking Show was previously recorded, so please sit back and enjoy the soothing sounds of The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio.
Hey.
Hey.
Welcome, everyone, to The Talking Show, K-Chung Radio's first and most substantial show of exclusively talking.
Exclusively.
K-Chung Radio is, of course, Chinatown, Los Angeles's oldest and most substantial micro-broadcasting radio station. I'm Steve Cato, and I'm relaxing in the studio here with Nicholas Miller.
That's right. We're together here in the K-Chung studio.
That's right.
Together.
And things are fully back on track. 2 weeks ago, we blew an episode. I'm learning how to drive. Gotten a little fender bender. This week, things are great. I just took Nicholas drifting up in the hills.
Yeah, a little scary, but it worked.
Pretty good, right? I'm good at this now.
You're okay. Yeah.
You know, it's amazing. It's amazing what you can learn when you put your mind to it.
Yeah. You could say that, Steve. You could say it.
But, you know, less pride get the best of me here, I think it's important to realize that we all have limits. And our guest in the studio today is the kind of person who would like to remind you of those limits, that no matter how in control of yourself you think you might be, you're probably not that in control of yourself. This is another of our long chain of commissions. We've asked this talking to be made for The Talking Show. And so it's a real special pleasure to have it. Please welcome Gwen Bianyara.
Take your hands. Make a relaxed claw shape with either hand and turn your wrists outwards so your nails are facing you. Take any fingernail and match it with another nail on the other hand. Make them touch. Draw them out so they touch only at the side, as if they are nuzzled against one another. You'll notice what looks like two people cuddling and smiling at each other, like they are in love. Regardless of how your nails are cut, either jagged or in an almost straight horizontal line, or with the corners shorter than the middle. Fingernails look like smiling human faces. Recently, I was hanging out in a restaurant, staring at its really dumb mirrored interior, mostly the wall that was right in front of me. I sat there for a while, about 30 minutes, waiting for my meal to show up, trying to mentally compile a list of my favorite TV shows and movies with the best eating noise overdubs. And I sat there for probably 15 minutes, making a variation of sounds When the server dropped my order, and I realized I was ripping off about 3/4 of my index fingernail with my teeth, I looked down and paired it against my longer unbitten nails on my left hand. They still looked like two little human faces cuddling in love or in lust, and that was pretty cool. The neuropsychological properties are uninteresting, but those properties aside, there is never a good, valid reason to bite. But for me, what I am reminded of, when I am reminded that I am biting my nails, is my personal absolute reason for biting. It is also one of my biggest personal embarrassments. When I was a teenager, I published a book of poetry. It was eventually reviewed by a well-known and reputable American publication. At the time, they had a review column just for young adult poetry. The review was very, very bad. It was arguably worse than the book I had somehow gotten published. It was reckless and unapologetically morphed the nature of my work. There were really harsh assumptions that this person, this reviewer, deducted upon these like really old-fashioned, like just these cliched armchair psychoanalytic ideas. Things about my parents, my sexual orientation, and my mental health. Being a teenager at the time, I lacked the emotional maturity and the tact to deal with issues this big. And so in retaliation, I wrote an inflammatory letter to the editor. To the book's editor. Regarding the review of Gwendolyn E. Binyara's Twirling Hair, Leaking Styrofoam. Review published on May 23rd, 2002. This is predictable blah, 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 blah reporting and writing. First, it is ill-written, and hence it is ill-edited. Second, it is inaccurate. Third, it is unintelligent in the most vulgar way. I spit on you, and I spit on your shit-for-brain staff. There is absolutely no evidence of unresolved hostility towards my family and any of the poems under review, especially because all of my poems were about LiveJournal, Krispy Kreme, and the photo booths at Pacific Mall. The only unresolved hostility I have is towards you and the dumbass you somehow employ who pours out that drivel you feel fit to publish in your young adult poetry section. You have no tact, you have no manners, you have no awareness of what it is to be a teenager. How dare you insult and attack me as a person in such a public arena, especially during the time when everyone knows it as the most vulnerable time in a person's life. Look in the fucking mirror and think about what you've done. If you can, you disgusting piece of dust. Thank you for reminding me and all of your readers why your publication sucks. Go fuck yourself. In regards, Gwendolyn Elizabeth Binyara, Whitby, Ontario, May 27th, 2002. I was 16 when this happened. And for approximately 3 years or so, I had to endure a variety of harassments and laughs until everyone forgot about it. As time passed and I grew closer to adulthood, my Google search results were updated with more current and less incriminating things. And for that, I am very, very relieved. You know, the internet in the early 2000s was just a little less mature than it is today. And that is one of the saving graces of this situation. There is no online archive of this letter to the editor, and I will always take relief in that thought. Since 2002, I've tried to avoid befriending bibliophiles, especially those with interests in millennial, early millennial, young adult poetry. I also want to say that's why I don't read anymore, but I feel like if I say that, people might, I don't know, they'll think... Anyways, now that I have some distance to this experience, as it's been about a decade since or so, you know, it's still a tender spot for me, and it still stings. And I mean, thinking about it drives me to bite and reminds me of why I bite if I ever have to. And there are other things to consider. We could ask questions about nail biting, the way people who study the nature of ideas ask questions about big things. A person may bite their nails over intellectual rejection. Sexual rejection. Thinking about failure, the potential for failure in preparing for responsibility, in being in a state of being responsible to someone else, for someone else, or oneself, or for a group of people. Being over-caffeinated can drive a person to bite their nails. Being in a frenzied mental state that is induced by low blood sugar can cause someone to bite their nails. Boredom. Definitely boredom, for sure. People with normal unbitten nails, and I've only experienced this for a very brief time in my life. I went a year without biting my nails, and then I started biting them again. But anyways, I digress. People with normal unbitten nails have hands that look safer. They appear to be safer hands because they have clean, proper nails, untouched and manicured and right and just. People with normal nails, unbitten nails, appear to be, yeah, they have safer hands. They have more compliant hands. They have more practical hands. They are more observant to the rules. And they are hands that uphold a precedent and possess clarity. Women with long nails. And I've only experienced this merely as a tourist. I've had fake nails put on. And those lasted about a week until I don't know what I did with them. I think I destroyed them not with my teeth, but with other things and tools. Like, I jabbed a nail through one once. But anyways, women with long nails generally have more power. Women with long nails generally have more righteousness and rectitude. And they generally have more hand beauty. Men with long nails generally are seen as either wizards, or they're lazy, or they're guitar virtuosos, or they're narcotic users. Men don't have long nails as often because men work or whatever, something like that. Possessing bitten nails renders a person susceptible to ridicule. The person who possesses bitten nails maps a nervous disposition on their hands. They also potentially map a poetic disposition. Biting your nails is a misguided reaction against and in allyship with one's own faulty body. Biting nails and possessing bitten nails is a show, no, shows, renders a person a lot lacking composure. It's a loss of composure. It's a loss of will. Biting nails is a thinking action pose or a series of poses. It's a choice, but it's never experienced that way. The best thing about biting nails is that it's obscene and it's totally vulgar. It's vulgar because it's gross. I mean, no one wants to sit beside the guy or the woman or the kid sitting on the bus who chews their nails so loudly. You hear this like, clip, clip. And it sounds like they're clipping their nails. Some people actually do that on the subway. But, say on the bus, people bite their nails. And, you know, sometimes they just bite them so loudly. And, I don't know, you know, no one wants to sit beside a person like that. And no matter how much I can sympathize and identify as a nail biter, I just can't get behind that kind of thing. But I can get behind the fact that I don't like that. And that's because it's obscene and it's vulgar and it's gross. The desire to bite nails. It's a call. It's like, you know, being those who can hear it bite their nails. Those who don't bite. But we hear a call. And
We are given the call and we heed it. And it always presents itself at the most inopportune time. The desire to bite nails could happen while walking down the street in a postured, fashionable outfit. The nail-biting individual may say something silently like, "Look at me, don't look at me, look at me, don't look at me, look at me, look at me, don't look at me. You're looking at me, you're looking at me, look at me, don't look at me. Look at this outfit, look at my hair, look at me, don't look at me. Why are you, don't look at me, why are you looking at me? Ignore me, don't look at me, you creep, don't look at, okay, you look at me, don't look at me." And this happens every time any person walks by. A person who bites nails is generally a person who is sensitive to being looked at or looking at other people. A couple of months ago, I served a table. I coughed into my hands. I poured their wine, gave them a pen, wiped my runny nose with my hand, and turned around so my hair brushed for a second against a beer tap. And then I began to assemble a gin martini. To the right, two young women show each other their photo print sundresses they bought 2 hours earlier. And to the left, a group of about three women in their late 40s, early 50s, share a bottle of wine and eat arugula salads. Two of them cry about the similar emotional states their 14 to 16-year-old daughters are experiencing, while the other one sits there with a deadpan look on her face. Three tables down, two middle-aged men who were regulars make small talk with me about things that could be bigger than how we're talking about them. They kept me at their table for about 15 to 20 minutes, but that was mostly because I was being too nice and there was nothing else for me to do. First, they made some dumb, predictable comment about how reliant we are on technology when their credit card wouldn't properly swipe on the portable point-of-sale machine. Then, one of them asked me how I felt to work in a place where I had to wear a uniform. I said I didn't mind it because as a decision within a restaurant, its intent is to dull the comparisons between staff. Something that affects both tips and check averages. The man who asked me was outraged by my answer and said, "But doesn't this make you feel like you're just a robot?" "Sure," I said, and I giggled. "But it's actually pretty okay, because, and its intention, it's kind of one of the only, like, maybe the only egalitarian thing you can find in a restaurant." And then I trailed off. I didn't really finish my idea or my conversation with them, mostly because I thought the conversation was really stupid. This one time, I lived without a garbage can and abandoned the rules for putting my stuff away in both my living and working quarters as a kind of experiment or exercise in personal freedom. I snapped a photo of the mess on my phone. In one particular photo, a small decorative table holds up an intact but dirty full-length mirror, a half-full sunscreen bottle, tea tree oil, a makeup brush, and a little plastic tub of hot sauce from a takeout meal sit atop the table. On the floor, an IKEA plastic tarp-like bag holds a bunch of freshly laundered towels. Next to the bag, a corrugated cardboard box, which came in the mail from Amazon, holds a roll of masking tape, one pink sock, a bobby pin, and a pair of tweezers. Mugs, maybe about 9 or 10 of them. Half were moldy with dried coffee, two with caked on dried kale smoothie pulp. And on the floor in front of the IKEA bag, a green notebook. Somewhere else, a plastic wrapper from a tampon hid underneath a transfer. Beside it, a lighter, one neon orange earplug, hair, nail clippings, dust bunnies, ash, leaves, sunflower seeds, sit in organically gathered groups on the floor, near the back, corner, desk legs. A brown woolen Ralph Lauren sweater with a hole in the seam between the shoulder and the sleeve. A beige cashmere scarf. A cotton white and blue striped button-up boy's shirt. A black purse. A maroon canvas backpack. One running shoe. Two mint green terry cloth slippers. Sephora brand lip balm. Crumpled receipts from the grocery store and a used bookstore, all covered in lint, hair, nail clippings, dust bunnies, leaves, strewn on my bed. 13 pennies, 7 quarters, 4 bobby pins, some dried rice and bean crumbs, a tube of mascara. They all hang out under the top sheet. The fitted sheet is stained with coffee, menstrual blood, turmeric, smeared ash, and a tiny bit of dark blue pen ink. I bit my nails in the process of cleaning up after I decided I was over attempting cutesy experiments, mimicking what lawlessness was like to live in. As nail biters, even if our nails are short and we hurt ourselves in the process, so what? If we make our hands bleed from gnawing off like a maniac, who cares? We can still pick things up. We may not be able to peel off the label from a bottle of beer, but we can still hold it, and we can still drink it, and we can still look at it. And that is pretty cool. So now, my nails, they are both long and bitten. I bite only 2 nails, the farthest left on either hand, the left pinky and the right's index. Both are chopped short, maybe almost half of the finger. They're wispy, they lack delineation, and they are framed by tough, jagged, raw skin. When I nuzzle them together, they look like 2 mangled, demented cartoon faces in love, maybe lust. They look like the kind of people I want to know and befriend. They look cool and interesting and full of ideas that are just a little bit different than mine. They are the perfect, creative, duo to have around. Another time I ripped off my whole pinky fingernail. When I returned to an old apartment 2 weeks after I had moved out because I had forgotten a few items. I didn't know my former roommates very well. I told no one I was returning. No one was home. I walked the softest I've ever walked, despite knowing there would be nobody who could confront me. I breathed as quietly as I could, the whole time my pinky in my mouth pacifying me, or in a vain attempt to, through the experience of intruding into a home of whom were otherwise strangers. But, you know, I was 20 at the time, and a day after I got my Hinkle's knife set back, my ripped off nail got infected. Do I want to live in a world where I can do something like bite my nails? Fuck yeah, I do. I'm glad I have teeth. I want to live in a world where I can bite my nails. Just like I want to live in a world where my toothbrush is always accessible, where I can daydream about whatever I want, where I can copy every idea, and I can pretend I'm in battle to get through things. But for the record, military clothing is kind of dumb. I have yet to dream and sleep about war, but I will indulge in daydream motivational fantasies where, in times of physical and/or emotional duress, I compare my state and responsibilities to that of anyone who has been in militarized combat and in battle, either voluntarily or otherwise. It acts as a way to remind myself that, as a human, other people have been through tougher shit, and I need to shut the fuck up and get shit done. While I didn't night dream about war, and I haven't yet, but maybe one day I will, the idea of daydreaming about war sounded like it could be a promising thing to consider, like the way that I consider nail biting. So I consulted the place that's widely accepted as the place where the gods once dwelled and have since vacated, the internet. Because I no longer know now how to be a person without arranging ridiculously categorized pieces of information like the stuff that Wikipedia is made of. So I Googled dreaming about war. I found a really helpful and insightful and exciting Yahoo question. It's specifically found at https://answers.yahoo.com/question/index?qid=201204112003 1aabb(m)n. Or you could just Google dreaming about war. Dreaming about war. Meaning? The poster writes, I had a dream last night that I was patrolling in Afghanistan and there was only one child in a certain village we went past. We stopped to talk to the locals, and I got quite close to the child, who was called Banaji. We were talking about how he wanted to be a doctor, and I was giving him chocolate.
Sorry.
and we got quite close. Then he hugged me. And thanked me for helping fight the Taliban off. Then we had to go. So I got up and said bye, and suddenly we started taking small arms and mortar fire. I looked over to Banaji, and a mortar came down and blew him up. I woke up nearly in tears and hyperventilating. I'm due to go to Afghanistan in 2014, so could that have anything to do with it? Best answer, as chosen by voters. Many people think that dreams mean something, but that isn't necessarily true. Dreams actually mean nothing, although it probably is not what you want to hear, but that is the truth. Although it may be disappointing, but modern medicine has proved that dreams are nothing more than a succession of images recalling past memory. I'm sorry if this is not what you want to believe. I will start off telling you that all dreams mean nothing. Dreams just express you or your emotions. They express what you feel and what you do in real life. That's why they feel so real. Dreams cannot create people, places, and things. That's another reason why they feel so real. Dreams recall past memory. For example, you see a person you don't recognize in dreams. You probably saw him before on TV or walking in the street. You probably didn't pay attention to them. Dreams express your emotions and thoughts in a symbolic way. According to the well-researched activation synthesis hypothesis, differences in neuronal activity of the brain stem during waking and REM sleep occur, and dreams result from that subconscious brain activation. If neuronal activity affects the dream, then it is concluded that emotions determine the structure and dynamics of a dream. The dream was about nothing. Dreams mean nothing just as they express your emotions and feelings in a symbolic way. Reoccurring dreams happen because you are having the same emotion. Thus, they get re-expressed in a similar dream. Lucid dreams occur, depending on the extent of your consciousness, during the phase of waking in REM sleep. Dreams are simple synapses in your brain firing off all sorts of things. Your brain gathers all this random information, sights, sounds, and so forth. And as you are sleeping, these sights, and essentially memories, are jumbled up into one big mess. Just random nonsense. And your brain works and works and works and works for an hour or so, trying to create a nice little story with all of these sights and sounds because it wants to make sense of it. It wants to make sense out of nonsense. So then you end up with this dream. This happens several times in one night, but when you wake up, you forget all of them. And when you do remember one of them, when you do remember at least one dream, we try to make sense of it. We tell ourselves, what is this? What could it mean? When in reality, it means nothing. It is just complete nonsense. Dreams are a succession of images, ideas, emotions, and sensations occurring involuntarily in the mind during certain stages of sleep. For more information, read the About Me section when you click on my account. Hopefully, this resolves your problems.
Ooh.
Yeah. Wow.
Wow, Nicholas.
Wow, Steve. Yeah. That was exciting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think about that thing she said about men with long nails? You know, I noticed that since you saw that Deleuze, since you got that Deleuze DVD that I think Semiotext put out, you know, you've been growing them awfully long, that I only wizards, the lazy, guitar virtuosos, or drug users had extremely long nails. What do you think of that, Nicholas?
Well, I don't think too much about Deleuze. I liked the cinema book. I couldn't get through the second one, but, you know, who could? Besides all those people at the public school. But anyway, but we've known each other, Steve, you and I, for quite a long time now, you know, on the scale of years. And I'm surprised it's never come up that I'm a classically trained guitar player. And I developed a taste for long nails during my classical guitar studies. I mean, I went through the entire Fernando Sor book, you know, the new edition with the black cover and the red text. Those exercises aren't easy, Steve. You know, you need the long nails on the nylon string to really get the guitar to work the way you want it to. I mean, to be frank, I didn't get all the way through the Segovia book, but that's like a whole nother level. That's like a different kind of obsession.
Hmm. Well, it is true. You are quite good at guitar. So, I suppose that does excuse it a little bit. I mean, the Deleuze comparison, I think, certainly also sort of rings true. I mean, you started imitating his hair, too, wearing his sweaters. I figured the nails are just sort of part of your Deleuze phase.
Are you kidding me? You trying to call me like a Deleuzer or something?
Oh.
I'm on this side of the Atlantic, Steve. I read people like Frederick Jameson. I'm not reading those continental idiots. This is America. And if you set off an explosive in America, even the Marxists want to shut down the city. We're going door to door with everybody else to find the person who did it.
You know what I thought was interesting about Gwen's piece was the way that she focused attention on growing up and living with the internet.
Yeah, I can relate. That was weird.
And how that was a phase that had a thing that had happened in her life that separated her from other people she was communicating with, i.e. A more established poetry community when she was younger, and how it still reflected back on how she was actually living her life now. I think that although that's probably true of almost everyone here that's listening to the station, I mean, most of the listeners of the station actually listen to the station through the internet. But it's the kind of thing that, especially in our talking that we've had, very few people have acknowledged. We still act like most of our communication is face-to-face.
Yeah. You know, like, I can't help but wonder, what would Tennyson think about Flarf poetry? You know, what would he think? Probably nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Your point is really well made. I mean, so far as the audience out there knows, hell, you and I, we could just be putting the show together through the internet. We aren't even here in the studio face to face like we are every week.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to go that far, we could even just recontextualize the whole project as Flarf poetry. We could be Flarf poets. All we'd have to do is change the website. We wouldn't even have to change the website. Just change their business cards. You know, instead of radio host, Flarf poets.
You know, it's very easy to imagine someone making a radio show as dynamic, as in real time as the talking show without any of this direct physical interaction.
Yeah. I mean, we could even have the physical interaction of being in the same room, but pre-record the episode to have it air later.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yep. The whole thing pre-recorded.
We'll have to try that sometime. Anyway, it's getting on in hours. I'd like to thank Gwen for coming out to the studio. A real pleasure to have you all the way from my hometown of Toronto. And it's, of course, been great to have all of you out there in Radioland joining us here, either via radio signal in the Chinatown area or via the internet. And I look forward to seeing all of you again next week.
Yeah. We encourage you to pop by the studio next week. Just drop in on us.
That's right, Nicholas. On The Talking Show, K-Chung Radio's finest talking show.
Sweet dreams. Sleep tight.
Good night, everybody.